Hello. We are excited to have you today for our podcast. I hope you will find this one as exciting and as challenging as I do. Today, our topic is understanding early brain development so teachers can close the gaps in learning. When I first started studying brain development, I felt like I really didn't understand a lot about the brain. But as I began to learn more and more, I became very challenged to understand what is really happening. So we're going to start our discussion today with just some basic facts about brain development. And I used some research by Alexandra Diamond and Victoria Whitting. And they begin by telling us that the quality of the child's earliest environment is critical to the strength of the developing brain architecture. And then this, in turn, determines their future capacity to learn, their physical and mental health, and their ability to regulate emotions. So as I see it, there's a lot riding on the child's environment. They make an interesting statement that says we need to close the gap between what we know and what we do. And I think about, I've taught a lot of different ages over the years. And this past year, I worked with third graders. And there are a lot of learning gaps these children have. And I often wonder what has caused these gaps. So I know there's gaps, but what am I going to do about it? So as early childhood educators, we have to understand that we have a role in developing our students' brain architecture. So we have got to have a common knowledge as educators about experience-based development. And then we've got to know how to apply that in our classrooms. And not only that, but I feel like we also need to share that knowledge with our parents. So when Diamond and Whitting did their research, they actually developed a 12-week course for teachers. And their goal in this coursework was to enable their graduates to better support child development through extending the teacher's knowledge base and then requiring them to make links and apply them to their classroom practices. So, as I mentioned before, we need to understand, but so do the parents. And really kind of what's interesting as I was reading and researching is it's a little odd to me that teachers are teaching parents about brain development more than doctors are, psychologists are, psychiatrists are. And I think that's really interesting. So if that's true, we need to understand the science behind brain development. And I think sometimes we're afraid to dig in because that's pretty deep. So we've got to have research basis behind our actions in the classroom, how we teach, and what we tell our parents. So the first thing we need to understand if we're going to enhance a child's brain development is we've got to provide a safe, stimulating, and invigorating environment where the children have all types of opportunities to develop and grow and learn. We also have to reduce the child's stress level. And we can do that through having a predictable classroom. Children do not like schedules changed. We need calm routines, not that hurry up, we got to move to this, we got to do that. We've got to have calm routines. We also have to have soothing touch. Children really like to know you approve of them, that you love them, you appreciate them. So just a little pat on the back or a gentle touch to the arm, just a soothing touch has really positive effects. So we want those positive cortisol levels. Now, what we have to understand is, and this is what I kind of hurt for as an educator, a lot of our children come from toxic homes, toxic environments, where there is not predictability, where there is not calmness, where there is not soothing touch. And unfortunately, the home environment is going to affect what happens in our classroom. So we need to be able to communicate to parents. And I'll be honest, they're not going to tell you everything that's going on at home if it's not a positive environment. Older children will express it. You can often see it expressed through younger children, even though they cannot verbalize it. But the more we can find out about what is happening at home, then hopefully we can create a better environment there. We need to have resources available to parents when they're in toxic situations. We need to know local counseling services. We need to know psychiatric services that are available. How do we get people out of volatile situations where somebody could be in danger? We as teachers also know when it's appropriate to call Child Protective Services and make a report, because sometimes these children have to be taken out of toxic environments because it's affecting their brain development. Brain research also tells us that quality, reliable relationship will strengthen the child's development in all domains. So let's take a minute to talk about brain plasticity. So Sandra Torzo from the Department of Child and Family Studies in the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, she wanted us to look at brain plasticity a little differently. We know that the brain is consistently building and creating new neurons. And there are several fascinating studies that also show that when a brain is severely damaged, those connections can be rebuilt. And there's a lot of research done on it, just amazing research that's out there. But she wants us to remember that it doesn't just have to be an injury for plasticity to take place, because the brain is a continuously changing system that's always in motion. All right, so let's think a little bit, because we're dealing with infants up. Let's think about prenatal development for just a moment. And you might be thinking, well, there's not a lot I can do about it. Well, I believe there is, because a lot of times we have older siblings in our classes, and so there are some things we can offer to these moms as they're going through pregnancy. First of all, we need to understand that the brain is affected in the prenatal stage by the outside world through malnutrition, stress, disease, things like alcohol, nicotine, medications, and illegal drugs. They are very harmful to a child, and they can even cause birth defects. We need to offer services to parents or guide them to the right place where they can get proper prenatal care. As one can imagine, there's extreme brain development in utero, but we have got to train the parents how to care for themselves so the brain can develop correctly. So we talk about children developing their brain, creating connections, and there's an amazing video that you could actually find on YouTube. It's fascinating. And what happens in this video is two men go to build a bridge across a huge chasm. And it takes a whole lot of work to do it. They begin by throwing a rope across the canyon with a spike on it. Several times the spike doesn't connect on the other side. Finally, the spike connects and they've got one rope across. Then they do it again and they have another rope across. And step by step, they begin building a suspension bridge simply with wood and string. Now, you and I both are agreeing we wouldn't be up there. That would be too scary. But this is what the brain does. We introduce something new, and sometimes it doesn't make a connection. But throughout, over and over and over, the connection finally gets built. And at the end of the video, the men are easily walking across this huge canyon with no trouble at all. And that's what happens in a child's brain. There was an article published by NACI, which is the National Association for the Education of Young Children, and it was written by Ronald Lally and Peter Manajone. And there's a very clear finding about brain development, and they know a brain of a child is directly influenced by the day-to-day interactions with a child's caregiver. That includes in daycare and at home. Now, before a child is given birth to, they have already started building in these expectations of adults and those who care for them. So when they're born, these expectations are there. And as we meet these expectations, the brain experiences pleasure and delight. And as the brain has these experiences, then the children begin to be more comfortable and at ease with their caregivers. Now, if these needs are not met, the child suffers. And that makes for a shaky development of the brain. And if this brain is not developed properly just through these simple steps, then it can affect their intellectual and language development early on. So at birth and even before birth, the child should be experiencing pleasure and delight in knowing that people are going to care for their needs. So it's really important from the very first time they walk into our early childhood program that they know they are loved, so that we can start developing that brain positively. During the first 3 years of life, the children go through what seems to be this helplessness stage. And we might see that as a negative. However, it's a positive stage of development, because this is where they're building even more pathways. And these pathways that they're building lead to future social, emotional, language, and intellectual functioning. So what does that mean for our teacher? What does that mean for our classroom? Well, first of all, the children need to be safe in our environment, and they need to know that, and they need to experience that. Their environment also needs to be interesting. We need to have things that pique their curiosity, and those need to change. I truly believe even in an infant classroom, they need to see things that are different that will pique their curiosity. Their environment also needs to feel intimate. We cannot be overstimulating, so we have to think that through. We always want to make our classroom super, super cute, but are we doing too much? And they also need to just feel secure and know that they can trust you no matter what. So let's talk a little bit about reading and the brain. There's some really fascinating research here too. And Nancy Frey and Douglas Fisher wrote an article titled "Reading and the Brain: What Early Childhood Educators Need to Know." And the fact is, most young children without disabilities can learn to speak or listen. However, they are not going to all become fluent readers and writers. And I have to tell you, I'm seeing that. I'm seeing children come through that are not fluent readers and writers. So what can I do to change this? Well, let's think through some of these facts that Frey and Fisher have pointed out. So reading occurs through intentional appropriation of existing structures within the brain. So that means the children have the right structures, but these structures don't necessarily know how to read. So let me just give you an example. So in order to read, here's what has to happen. The brain has to figure out a way to convert the occipital region of the brain, which is originally designed to recognize objects, but the child has got to convert it where it recognizes letters and words, not just objects. Then that letter and word recognition must be further coordinated with the auditory area of the brain to process sounds in language into meaningful strings. So there's a lot going on right there. So this is kind of what they came up with, and this is a direct quote from their research. It says, this loop between the occipital lobe, Broca's area in the left front lobe, which is language processing, and Wernicke's area in the left temporal lobe, which is language comprehension, they must be trained to coordinate efficiently. Now, I'm looking at this as an educator and thinking, wow, this is why our children are struggling to learn. Because as educators, I'm sorry, I don't think we even understand that. So what does that mean for us as classroom teachers? First of all, it means that we have to be exposing our children to print, and that means books, magazine, posters, anything like that, at a very early age, if we are going to change reading instruction and make our children more successful. We also need to be reading to them and talking to them. We need to encourage parents to do this at home. I tell parents all the time when they ask, how can I help my child's reading? Read to them at home. And they look at you like, what do you mean? Don't they need to be reading? Well, yes, they do. But we need to be reading to them also. Our classrooms also need to provide rich learning experiences. We need to ensure that students can hear, that they can process, and they can produce language. That has to be available in our classrooms. We also need to understand that we're building a neural pathway in the child's brain when we're reading. And when we do that, then we're developing written language comprehension, and they're able to produce written comprehension better. So another interesting fact I found is we need to, from a very early age, connect reading experiences with things such as eating, being held, and receiving attention. And this is why. That creates a pleasure path in the brain that connects reading with enjoyment. So think about, we can have an infant in our lap, rocking, cuddling them, reading them a book. We can have a child in our lap on the floor reading to them. Maybe it's snack time and we're reading a book. There are so many ways, but children need to connect reading with pleasure. I hear students say all the time, Mrs. Cooper, I don't like to read. Maybe we didn't make those connections when they were younger, but I don't think it's ever too late. So when children learn something, neurons are firing, and it's that repeated firing that leads to the physical changes that over time, with repetition, become permanent. So we've got to know that with neuroplasticity and the brain's ability to build new pathways, actions can permanently alter the learner's brain. But we have to be really intentional about that in the classroom. So another thing I want to talk about here briefly, and we could talk about this for a long time, is how repetition leads to automaticity. And automaticity meaning being able to do something easily, like 2 plus 2 is 4. CAT spells cat, on and on. So there are three areas of the brain that are actually used in the early stages of learning. And they are the prefrontal cortex, the parietal cortex, and the cerebellum. Now, these three areas work together to allow the learner to pay attention, to execute correct movement, and then sequence steps or do things in sequence. So as these pathways are used repeatedly, and let's think about that video that I tried to help place in your head earlier, they kept going over and over, building this bridge across that canyon. All right, they did it over and over until they were able to complete it. So the same thing, we are repeatedly giving students information so that they're beginning to change physically and form steadily faster networks. And when those networks are built and they're gone over and over and over, the child becomes more fluent. It also allows them to create that necessary think time, and then that forms new connections. So I think about in our district, we ask, we beg our parents, read to your child 20 minutes a day. Expose your child to reading 20 minutes a day. Think about the difference that 20 minutes a day would make. Think about the things in our classroom that we introduced and we think, oh, I need to go on, and we move on past it. Children need that repetition and they like that repetition. We can change it up. We can challenge them on a different level. But that repetition needs to be there if we're going to build those pathways in the brain that are easily accessible. So I love this statement by Nancy Frey and Douglas Fisher. And it says, automaticity is an important tool for teachers because of its relationship to fluency and understanding. Fluent reading is positively associated with comprehension and is thought to contribute to the learner's ability to process the meaning of the text because less effort is required to recognize symbols, decode, and assign meaning to words. I really want you to think about this. If a child, and I need you to understand this happens, if a child in second and third grade and they are still decoding one sound at a time, they're not going to read fluently. They're not. And if they can't read fluently, they are not going to remember what they are learning and reading. So here's what we have to understand, though, and this is huge to me. It is not about getting students to read faster, because they can do that. Jack ran across the stage was crooked, and they can just go on and on and on. Then you can ask them, what did you just read? And they look at you because they don't know. It's not about reading faster. That is not leading them to a higher level of understanding or engagement. They have to build pathways that fire consistently. So yes, they are reading fluently, but meaning is coming along and they are understanding and building a picture in their head. We also have to understand, and this is my last point, that as we build automaticity, that we are not getting in a rut. Let's challenge them. Let's give them something on a different level. Do we need to change it up? Yes, we do. So there are so many important things about the brain there. I hope you have some takeaways from that. And thank you for joining us today. Have a great day.